forecast that the Republican ticket of Harding and Scalise is running well ahead of Cox and Roosevelt. At the present time, Harding has collected more than 16 million votes against some 9 million for the Democrats. We'll give you the state vote in just a moment. But first, we'd like to ask you to let us know if this broadcast is reaching you. Please drop us a card, address station KDKA, Westinghouse, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Writer Anthony Rudell's newest book, Hello Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio, is more than just a history of radio's earliest days. Through stories that connect goat tissue with snake oil salesmen, shock jocks and Sarah Palin, FDR and President Obama, Rudell sets forth the idea that whatever the media does today was actually conceived between 1920 and 1932 on American radio. Rudell is a radio expert. He spent 10 years as a radio broadcaster and was one of the youngest ever on-air personalities at WQXR, the classical station of the New York Times. He's also written one novel and two books on classical music, and I'm pleased to welcome him to the show today. Hello.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
So you've spent a great deal of your career talking on and about radio. What exact period of American radio history are you focusing on in your new book?
The book is 1920 to 1932, and the clip you began with actually is a recreation of the moment when commercial radio was born, when KDKA broadcast the election results of the Harding against Cox race in November of 1920. So I begin there, and I trace it through 1932 following five themes: politics, news, religion, sports, and entertainment, which are the five core parts of broadcasting or any kind of media we deal with today. And the characters back then were amazing. I mean, you had anybody could start a radio station. You just needed a transmitter, and they weren't very expensive to build. So you had incredible characters starting up radio stations all across the country. And then it became went from being a hobby very quickly to becoming a business. And by 1925, it was a multi-million dollar business.
And of all of the time sort of periods that you could have focused on, why did you sort of come down on that period between 1920 and 1932?
Well, much has been written about what's called the golden age of American radio, 1932 to 1950, roughly, when all the great shows were on, Burns and Allen and The Shadow and things we all know. And I started looking back and I realized that no one had really focused on the content portion of 1920 to 1932 when this entire industry was built. So I went back and started finding unusual programming that people did. I mean, amazing thing was we live in this 24/7 society where you can flip on the internet anytime you want and hear something or turn on the radio and hear something. Back then, they turned the transmitters on and off depending on when they had something to do. There was a wonderful article I read from a 1920-something newspaper in San Francisco, 1921, I think it was, radio station announced they were going to turn their transmitter on Thursday afternoon at 3 because there was a guy in town who could whistle the first act of Carmen. And so they turned the transmitter on for his performance and then turned it off. So it was a very different era from what we know today, but it built the foundation of the media business.
And tell us, who exactly was Dr. John Romulus Brinkley and why it mattered that he was this cross between a somewhat respected medical authority and a vaudeville showman?
John Brinkley is the most amazing American, purely American character. He had his medical degree from the Kansas State Eclectic University, which cost him $100 to get by mail. And he was living in a town called Milford, Kansas, when not doing particularly well, when he invented a surgery, which I can't go into great detail on, but let us say it was the 1920s version of Viagra. And he became very famous for this, and he went to Los Angeles, where Harry Chandler, the owner and publisher of the Los Angeles Times, challenged him to perform the surgery on his editors and said to him, if it works, I'll make you a millionaire. If it fails, I'll turn you into a goat, so to speak. So he did the surgery and apparently in the space of 4 weeks made $40,000 in Los Angeles performing the surgery on various silent movie stars. But while he was there, KHJ, which was the radio station owned by the Los Angeles Times, went on the air. And Brinkley thought this is the way to market, went back to Milford, Kansas, built his radio station, KFKB, which stood for Kansas First, Kansas Best, and became one of the most powerful broadcasters in the country. Unfortunately, the American Medical Association caught up with him, and they shut his radio station down. But then he ran for governor, And that story I don't want to tell because I don't want to ruin the book for people.
and what are they broadcast and who owned the station?
He owned the station. I mean, it was his completely. And he accepted no commercials. It was a non-profit, non-commercial radio station, I should say, not non-profit. But he invented the infomercial. He would go on the air and tell people about the medicines you could buy from him. And he'd go on the air and you could come to Milford and have this amazing surgery that he invented. And he made millions upon millions of dollars.
So was it just really a platform for his surgical procedures?
Exactly. But what was amazing is he was one of the first broadcasters to build a complete program schedule. His radio station went on at 5 o'clock in the morning and it continued until midnight. And there was something filling every hour, including live orchestra, live yodelers, a fortune teller. I mean, it was the most amazing, eclectic mix. And his signal was so powerful that it got into New York from Milford, Kansas. So he covered most of the country.
And do you see any modern versions of what he was doing on
absolutely.
The radio?
Well, it's not so much on the radio. Well, it's on the radio to some degree. But if you turn on cable television late at night and you hear the miracle cures, call 1-800 and then the phone number, it's exactly what he was doing. The foundation of that was back then.
I'm Daljit Dhaliwal here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. So how many people had radio in their homes then at that time?
Well, the number I like to use that I kind of find amazing is that when that 1920 broadcast of the election results was done by KDKA, they estimate that somewhere between 500 and 1,000 people heard it. 12 years later, when Roosevelt beat Hoover in November of 1932, they estimate that 60 million Americans heard it. So there's a sense of the growth of the industry from 500 people in 1920 to 60 million in 1932, which is a faster growth rate than almost any other business.
Mm. And how has radio changed, do you think, by 1922? Did individuals mostly own licensed stations, or did some companies mostly own them then?
Everything had to be licensed by the Commerce Department, which is where Herbert Hoover comes in. And he, as Commerce Secretary from 1921 to 1928, was absolutely a genius in terms of the way he built the industry. But by 1925, you start to see this sort of schism between the individual owner, the guy in Milford, Kansas with his radio station, and people making money, the RCAs of the world, the General Electrics of the world. And then by 1926, RCA forms the National Broadcasting Corporation, and you have network radio suddenly. And it goes from a hobby to this huge national coast-to-coast business. And that's what's really fascinating about it. And in terms of it was this content, these individuals who built up the idea, and then the corporations descended. But, you find some very unusual ownerships. There was Gimbel's Brothers department stores owned radio stations because they thought it would be a great way to get the message out about what they had for sale. Mm-hmm. So, Wanamaker's in Philadelphia owned a radio station. But then as time went on, they got sold off.
And how did FDR use the radio to pull together America at that time?
FDR was amazing. I mean, he outmaneuvered Hoover in the 32 election. He understood the importance of instantaneous coverage, of instantaneous response. So when the Republicans would attack, Roosevelt went right on the air and responded. In 33, when he gave his first what became known as the fireside chats, he understood the intimacy of the medium, that you were talking one-on-one with 60 million people. And he was brilliant at doing it. There's a wonderful letter that was sent to him that I read by Lillian Gish, the great actress, who said that his voice sounded as if it had been dipped in phosphorus. He had this wonderful resonant baritone that just made people feel comfortable. And because radio was the only electronic medium, he didn't have to compete, as President Obama does today, with 700 voices coming from all directions. He could be the bully pulpit, and it was rather amazing.
And the Radio Act of 1927, what would you say that its significance and impact was?
Well, it set standards for one thing. It set ownership limits for another thing, which we've given up. I mean, the Fairness Doctrine grew out of that many years later. In 27, it was still a flawed document. There's a wonderful story. In 1928, a radio station went on the air with the sole purpose, announced purpose, of defeating Al Smith. You can imagine a radio station going on the air today and saying, our job is to defeat somebody. So it was a flawed document, but it established that this was a business, that the government realized that we needed to control the airwaves. And Hoover, who was brilliant as Commerce Secretary, maybe not so great as president, Hoover really understood how this medium, these airwaves, belong to the people. And if you read his memoirs, and I quote some of them in the book, he really understood the value of this means of communication and how it should be used. And of course, Roosevelt then used it exactly that way.
And why was November the 11th, 1928, a day that completely changed radio in America?
I can't remember. November 11th, 1928 was after the 28 election.
Okay, well, we'll have to go back
and look at that. I'm not sure why November... November 5th would have.
Oh, maybe
November
28th. Yeah.
That was when Smith was defeated by Hoover, who then becomes president. And, a year later, the market falls apart, and there's Hoover not knowing how to use anything to save the country.
Well, let's move to another date,
please.
1912. Before radio actually got going in the 1920s, you also mentioned that the Titanic disaster, mm-hmm. which took place in 1912, is part sort of help that led to Congress passing the act to regulate radio communication. What exactly was this, and what impact did it eventually end up having on radio?
There were several impacts. One is the importance of that date, of April 1912, is that suddenly you realize that this form of communication was instantaneous and could help people. The Titanic couldn't get messages through, was one of the problems, because there were so many amateurs blocking the airwaves with Morse code and whatnot. But on a personal level, what happened was there was an operator for the Marconi Company, a messaging operator in New York, named David Sarnoff, who, rumor had it, spent the entire night sending messages to try to get help to the Titanic. He then, of course, becomes the radio genius for RCA and goes on to build the RCA and NBC companies, and it was known as the General. So his career started on that night, mm-hmm. in effect.
And you also say that during its infancy, radio experimented with broadcasts of golf and tennis and boat racing, among other things, but that during the early 1920s, it really exploded on radio. Why was that?
Well, sports were the logical drama was sports. The 1921 fight between Carpentier and Dempsey was the first big radio bout. And people wanted to hear this. People suddenly had a reason to go get a radio. I mean, you mentioned those other sports, boat racing. My favorite was there was a ping pong tournament covered on radio, and I just can't imagine what that sounded like. But they tried everything. But the three sports that really drove it were boxing, because of the immediacy of it, baseball, because of Babe Ruth, and football, because college football was so important in those days. So those three were the driving influences. Mm.
And who's credited with really sort of helping to begin sports radio?
There are a number of people. RCA was big in that in their infancy. There's KDKA Pittsburgh was the first one to do a baseball game, although they ended up only doing four innings of it because I guess they got bored. But the characters themselves became the stars. You have Dempsey in boxing. You have Babe Ruth in baseball. You have Red Grange in football. And these characters become larger-than-life heroes that the audience wanted to hear about. And so it drove sports through radio that way. And it became more and more important. The World Series every year, baseball was not on the air every day. But by 1922, 1923, people were realizing the value of the World Series, especially in 23 when Yankee Stadium opened. And here we are many years later with a new Yankee Stadium, and we're going through a similar thing again.
As somebody who's been involved with radio for so long, what are your own sort of thoughts on how it's changed, how it's evolved? What do you think of the model that we have today?
Well, I mean, radio's been buried more times than you can count. I mean, when TV came along, everyone said, oh, that's the end of radio. And then, you know, when satellite came along, well, that's the end
of
radio.
And now we have the internet.
And now we have the internet, and everyone says it's the end of radio. I, for one, don't believe radio. There's an intimacy and an immediacy that radio gives that is just wonderful. I think the mass ownership of stations has been terrible for the country. I think that to have the same programming in 500 cities around, or towns and cities around the country, is not good. That what's beautiful about radio is the ability to get
what
local.
What does that do to the quality of programming? Why do you think
it's not good? Lowers it because you don't have that local connectivity. You have syndicated programming coming out of Los Angeles and New York, which they fought about, by the way, in 1926. It's the same battle being fought again. But these large groups of stations where, for example, new music doesn't get heard because it doesn't test well. This is a big problem. And, I mean, one of the great things about public radio is we have the ability here to do more things.
What about news on commercial radio? What are your thoughts on that? I mean, was that how it was sort of conceived as a model back in the early days of radio? Was that the intention?
No, the irony is that radio stayed away from news because it had this deal. It was this sort of love-hate relationship between the radios and the newspapers. Newspapers were deathly afraid of radio, except they didn't acknowledge it till 1931 when their revenues plunged. But they, the newspapers sort of kept the AP away from radios. Radio stations were not allowed to use AP news until after an extra edition had hit the streets. That changed in 1930, and I write about this in Hello, Everybody. The prison fire in Columbus, Ohio, where they happened to have WAIU, was the local station, happened to have a microphone and a transmitter in the prison when the prison caught on fire, and they broadcast the sound of 300 prisoners burning to death. And that suddenly changed the whole perception. And then the big moment that changed it was the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby when Boak Carter of the CBS network broke the story before the newspapers could.
Okay, Anthony Riddell will be speaking about radio theater from its roots to future. And that's tonight at 6:30 at the Paley Center for Media. That's on 52nd Street between 5th and 6th Avenues. And for more information about tickets, go to our show page at wnyc.org. Anthony Riddell, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.